It's just phenomenal. The prophecy that's already been fulfilled in order to give you and me encouragement and confidence that what has not yet been fulfilled is going to be fulfilled is true.
You're listening to Bible teacher Ann Graham Lotz on this weekly edition of Living in the Light, today in the book of Daniel. Here's Ann.
What major events can you think taking place in our world today? What major events are taking place in your life? A marriage, a birth, a death, some major event? Jesus is Lord over events. And in chapter 9, in the first three verses, we see that he is Lord over events that are planned. And I just want to look at these three verses again. I know you've probably memorized them at this point, but these three verses show us something else because they show us God's plan that includes events that happen to his people. You know from Jeremiah that we're told that God had planned the captivity of Israel would last 70 years, and then God had planned at the end of 70 years to bring them back out of captivity. So in other words, in these first three verses, because Daniel was reading the prophecy of Jeremiah, and he knew the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years, that the events of those times were planned in the type of event, in that it would be the desolation of Jerusalem, planned in the timing of the event. It would last for 70 years. He planned the termination of the event when Cyrus gave the decree and they went home. You see, he plans events, the timing, the type, and the termination. He is Lord over events. He himself plans them. They're all working according to his purpose in the world to bring about his will and his kingdom on earth. Not only are they planned, but they're planned precisely. And I want to go to the end of chapter 9. We've had the prayer, but I want to go to the end of chapter 9 and pick up the prophecy there. And if you get lost in this, that's all right. Just remember the main thought that the Lord is planning the events precisely. I mean, he has the days numbered. He's got it all figured out. It is such a comfort when you read your newspaper and you watch your news program at night on TV or in the morning to know that all of this is planned precisely by the one who is Lord. He is working it out for his own purpose and for his own glory. So let's look at the precision of the big picture in verse 24. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. That verse is describing God's working with the nation of Israel, working in them and through them to reveal himself to the world. And from the time, in verse 25, from the time that the decree goes forth to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. So the 77s, and one of Daniel's sevens represents a week, and each one of those days is a year. So 77s, you just multiply that. 70 times 7, you get 490 years. So 490 years from the time that Nehemiah goes back to rebuild Jerusalem would be God's workings with the nation of Israel. That would start the time clock. So there, in all of human history, until the return of Jesus Christ, there are 490 years when God will work in and through the nation of Israel to reveal himself to the world. So that's the big picture. He's got it all planned out. There are 490 years. All right, now look at the little pieces of this big picture. In verse 25, know and understand this. This time clock begins from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. The date for that is March the 4th, 445 B.C. It's when Artaxerxes told Nehemiah he could go back and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, Cyrus told Ezra he could go back and rebuild the temple, but that's not what this verse says. It says from the time the decree is issued that you can go back and rebuild Jerusalem, that was Nehemiah. So that's 445 B.C. Until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, speaking of Jesus, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. You add that together, you get 69 sevens. That's 483 years. So from the time of Nehemiah, when he goes back to Jerusalem, until the time that Jesus comes would be 483 years. After the 62 sevens and plus the other 7 sevens, which is the 69, the Anointed One, meaning Jesus, will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come, meaning the Romans, will destroy the city and the sanctuary, which they did in 70 A.D., And someone has figured it up based on a Jewish calendar that has 360 days to the year instead of our 365, that the date from the time Nehemiah went back to rebuild Jerusalem until Palm Sunday, when Jesus presented himself to the nation of Israel as their Messiah, was 483 years. So those 69 sevens have already taken place. Then when the Anointed One was cut off, of course, the end comes like a flood. War will continue until the end. And that was true until the end of the nation of Israel in 70 AD. But it's also making the transition to the end of the age as we know it. And now we're talking about the end of the age. He, and this is the ruler that will come, speaking of the ruler of this new Roman Empire, whether it covers the territory or just has its characteristics, we don't know. But speaking of the Antichrist, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1-7. And that 1-7, remember, represents 7 years. And so he will confirm a covenant with many for 7 years. And the covenant is primarily with Israel, allowing her to rebuild her temple, reestablish her sacrifices. He brings peace to the world as a result. In the middle of that 7, after 3.5 years, he puts an end to the sacrifice and the offering. He just breaks his covenant. And whereas Israel has been allowed to rebuild the temple and been allowed to have their sacrifices, now he breaks all of that. And the one who causes desolation will place abomination on a wing of the temple until the end that is decreed is poured out upon him. Now, I just want to leave that for a moment because we're going to talk about the abomination of the desolation. But I want you to look at the two little phrases in verse 26 and the end of verse 27 that have been decreed. That is decreed. Do you see? Who is decreeing this? The Lord. The Lord who is Lord over events, Lord over the big picture, Lord over these small pieces. And so he plans them as Lord, he plans the events, and he plans them precisely. And whether you can follow all of that or not, just praise the one who is Lord over events. And thirdly, he's Lord over evil. He's Lord over evil in chapter 11. He's Lord over evil that becomes progressively worse. And you know, it's interesting how evil in every generation just gets worse and worse and worse, doesn't it? And they said, what was it, 1950, the primary problems in schools were chewing gum, running in the halls, playing hooky. In 1980s, it was guns, drugs, rape. Evil just gets worse, and I think one reason is that evil has an insatiable appetite. It's never satisfied. It just has to get worse and worse and worse. And so we see a progression in the evil in the world or in history. So chapter 11, verses 1 to 4, we see that the evil that becomes progressively worse in that it's extensive. And in chapter 11, verse 2, now then I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and that's Cambyses, Pseudo-Sarmatus, Darius the First, Astyages, and you're not going to remember that, but put that in context. Then a fourth, who is Xerxes, by the way, the husband of Queen Esther, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. And Xerxes, in his pride, took the largest army that history had known up until that point, and he invaded Greece, and he was defeated by a brash young ruler named Alexander. And Alexander was in such a rage that Xerxes had attacked them that in revenge he turned and attacked Persia, and he overcame it, and then you have the Grecian Empire. Then a mighty king, who is Alexander, will appear. He will rule and with great power do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants because Alexander's two sons died, nor will it have the power he exercised because his empires will be uprooted and given to those four generals. Now that was written 216 years before the Grecian Empire, before Alexander was even born. It's just phenomenal. The prophecy that's already been fulfilled in order to give you and me encouragement and confidence that what has not yet been fulfilled is going to be fulfilled in as minute detail as this has been fulfilled. Every jot and tittle of this book is true. But the evil was progressively worse in that it was extensive at that point. Then it becomes very aggressive. Of course, Alexander was aggressive, but we see that emphasized in verses 5 to 8 when we have the king of the south, Ptolemy in Egypt, struggling for power against the king of the north, who is the king of Syria. We're not going to go in how they did it. It's just a seesaw battle. And what impresses me is that they're just very aggressive with each other. They're just vying for power. Then the aggression becomes oppressiveness in verses 9 to 20 as the struggle continues between the king of the north and the king of the south. And the king of the north wins, which is Syria. And Antiochus the Great ruled Syria. He overcame Ptolemy in Egypt until he ruled. And then his empire was turned over to his successor, whose name is Seleucus Philopater in verse 20, and he becomes oppressive. He sends out tax collectors to maintain the royal splendor and he taxed the people beyond even their ability to pay, and he was known in history as a very oppressive ruler. So the evil has been extensive, aggressive, oppressive, and then it becomes completely destructive. And before Christ, all of the evil of all of these rulers and empires just climaxed in one ruler named Antiochus Epiphanes, and he ruled from the empire of Syria. Antiochus Epiphanes named himself. Epiphanes means glorious, and he named himself glorious. But look what God says about him in verse 21. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person. Antiochus Epiphanes called himself glorious. God said he was contemptible because he was degraded, cruel, savage. And it said he had not been given the honor of royalty. He didn't come to the throne because he was born that way. He came by cunning and intrigue. In verses 21 to 24, it describes his plots and his intrigue. It says, after coming to an agreement with him, he acts deceitfully, and with only a few people, he rises to power. He's courageous in verse 25 because he defeats Egypt. Verses 25 to 28, we see that he is very corrupt. In fact, there's an interesting verse there in verse 27. The two kings of the north and south, including Antiochus Epiphanes, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail because an end will still come at the appointed time. But it reminded me of some of these peace treaties we see in signing some of these peace accords. And these two people sit down at the same table and they talk to each other, but they have lies on their lips and evil in their hearts, and the end is going to come at the appointed time. Who appoints the time? The Lord. And Antiochus Epiphanes has his end appointed, but it's not yet as far as Daniel's description is concerned, because he rules the whole area of Syria. And then at the appointed time, he will invade Egypt again, the south again. But this time, the outcome is different from what it was before, because Egypt hollers to the little new fledgling empire of Rome and says, Rome, will you come help us against this man Antiochus Epiphanes from Syria? And Rome sends ships who will oppose him, and he will lose heart. They defeat Antiochus Epiphanes. Do you know he is so humiliated that he turns in rage, and who is right in front of him but the little nation of Israel, just minding her own business? And he sends 22,000 troops into Jerusalem. They slaughter the worshipers in the temple. They ransack the city. They loot the shops. They rape the women. And then he sets up his rule in Jerusalem. He demands for them to worship God. He causes all the sacrifices to cease. He sets himself up as God, demanding they worship him. He dedicates the temple of God to Zeus. And then he changed the Feast of the Tabernacles to the Feast of Bacchus, where they just had these drunken orgies. And then over the brazen altar, where the sacrifices were offered in atonement for sin, he set up an idol of Zeus, and then in worship of this idol, he slaughters a pig. Absolute. That's the abomination of desolation, by the way. And it's important to know that, because Jesus said in Matthew 24, there is coming a ruler who, like Antiochus Epiphanes, is going to cause an abomination of desolation in the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the temple hasn't been rebuilt yet, but it will be. It's interesting, I read in Time magazine a couple of years ago, and I wish I had saved the article, because in Time magazine they said that there are Jews in Israel who have built the temple stone by stone. All the blocks are numbered. The robes for the priests have been sewn and are being kept and preserved. All the articles are done, and they didn't even know why. But it's all stored, and they said they could set it up within 3 days because it's all in place. The temple will be rebuilt. The sacrifices will be made, but Antiochus Epiphanes will do this horrible thing. And Jesus said, in the future, another ruler is coming who will do what Antiochus Epiphanes did. He will set himself up as God to be worshipped in the temple. He will cause the abomination of desolation. In Matthew 24, Jesus said, when you see that take place, and I pray to God I won't because I want to be out of here, but when you see that take place, he said, run for the mountains, hide, because that begins a period of suffering on earth unlike anyone has ever seen before. It ushers in what is called the time of great distress, the time of Jacob's trouble, the great tribulation, God pouring out his wrath on the earth. So I tell you a little bit about Antiochus Epiphanes because he is a type or a shadow of the Antichrist. Just to finish off Antiochus Epiphanes, he was a little band of faithful people described in Verse 32, with flattery, Antiochus Epiphanes corrupts those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. And there was a little group called the Maccabees. And the Maccabees revolted against Antiochus Epiphanes. And you know that little group of faithful Jews who believed in God, many of them were burned and captured and all of that. You can read about them at the end of Hebrews 11. But they were enabled by God to overthrow the Syrian Empire. They broke the power of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so you have the setting then for Rome to come in. And the next major event in Israel's life is when a little baby is born in Bethlehem. And John the Baptist comes to prepare the way, and Jesus comes on the scene as the Messiah. But Antiochus Epiphanes is defeated. But you can see in human history before Christ that evil was progressively worse. And it is in our day also. And even as before Christ it climaxed in the rule of Antiochus Epiphanes, in our day it's going to climax in the rule of the Antichrist. And the Antichrist now is described in verses 36 to 45. And so we see that Jesus is Lord over evil that's progressively worse, but also evil that's profanely wicked. And there's something about an evil person that can't let God alone. You know, they have to take God's name in vain. They have to be profane. They attack the things that are sacred. And of course, that's just the devil taking control of their lives because he's anti-Christ. So the evil not only becomes progressively worse, but it becomes profanely wicked. And we see that kind of profanity in the Antichrist. Verse 36, he is wicked personally. And by the way, verse 35, it says, some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. The little phrase, the time of the end, is now jumping ahead in prophecy to the end of the age as we know it. And it comes at the appointed time, and who appoints it? The Lord. And now the king, spoken of in verse 36, is the Antichrist. He is wicked personally in that he does as he pleases. He's very selfish. He's very humanistic. He magnifies himself above every god. He says unheard of things against the God of gods. He's profane. He's blasphemous. And he will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. And who has determined it? The Lord. But he is wicked personally. He's wicked religiously. Verse 37, he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. And I don't know what that means. And I've thought and thought and thought. But I don't know if that means, some people think that means he's Jewish, because the King James Version says the God of his fathers. NIV says gods of his fathers, which would indicate he's not Jewish. Maybe comes from some religious background where there are many gods. Maybe he's Catholic. Some people think he's Islamic. But it just, he shows no regard for the gods of his fathers. Whatever religious heritage he has means nothing to him. Or for the one desired by women. And the best suggestion I've heard for that is that in Daniel's day, the women of his day, meaning the women of Israel, desired more than anything to be the one through whom God would send the Messiah. So possibly the one desired by women is Jesus. He doesn't care about his religious background. He doesn't care about Jesus. Nor will he have any regard for any God. He doesn't care about any religion. In fact, Revelation says he wipes out all religions. And he will exalt himself above them all. Revelation describes how he sets himself up as God to be worshipped by the people of earth. Instead of them, he will honor a God of fortresses. And I don't know who the God of fortresses is, but I'm going to guess, because a fortress is a God of the military or God of power, and behind the God of military and war and fortresses is Satan. So apparently he's in league with Satan, which of course we know from Revelation he is, and a God unknown to his fathers. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones, costly gifts. Either he pours his money, actually, into the military, or it may mean that in some formal way he worships Satan, who is a god foreign to that of his fathers. But just get the point. He is wicked personally. He is wicked religiously. He is wicked politically. He will attack the mightiest fortresses. I wondered if we're in there. With the help of a foreign god, and we know from Revelation the foreign god could be represented by the false prophet who does miracles in his name. And he will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. In fact, he puts a mark on their forehead, 666, the mark of the beast. If you don't have that mark, you can't buy or sell. You can't even live economically in his world, because he honors only those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. He takes bribes. He's very corrupt. So he's wicked politically. And then he's wicked militarily. At the end of the time, the king of the south will engage him in battle. Somehow, The king of the south, representing, I think, more than Egypt, but Africa, maybe the Islamic nations who are tired and they're so strongly monotheistic, I'm sure they've been seething in rebellion and having to worship this man. Maybe that's what it is, or I don't know. But anyway, the people from the south engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him, and the king of the north is the Antichrist, storms out against him with chariots, cavalry, and a great fleet of ships. The Antichrist will invade many countries, sweeping through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land, which is the land of Israel. For some reason, Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon escape, and that's primarily the Jordanian area. But he extends his power over many countries. Egypt doesn't escape. He gains control of the treasures and the riches of Egypt and Libya. And at this point, which I'm assuming is about the midpoint of the seven-year period, and we get this from Revelation, he asserts his rule over the whole world. He's been ruling what was the former Roman Empire, whether that's the territory or just the characteristics, but he's been ruling those 10 nations. He took over the three, and then he takes over all 10, and he's been ruling there. But at this point, he goes and invades and takes over the rulership of the whole world. The Antichrist will invade many countries, sweeping through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land, which is the land of Israel. For some reason, Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon escape, and that's primarily the Jordanian area. But he extends his power over many countries. Egypt doesn't escape. He gains control of the treasures and the riches of Egypt and Libya. And at this point, which I'm assuming is about the midpoint of the seven-year period, and we get this from Revelation, he asserts his rule over the whole world. He's been ruling what was the former Roman Empire, whether that's the territory or just the characteristics, but he's been ruling those 10 nations. He took over the three, and then he takes over all 10, and he's been ruling there. But at this point, he goes and invades and takes over the rulership of the whole world. So after a time, he hears reports from the east, meaning Japan, Korea, China, that alarm him. From the north, Russia. But he hears reports that unsettle him, and he sets out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. And guess what? He pitches his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful, holy mountain in a place we know that is called Armageddon. And we know that the Lord is Lord over this evil. Zechariah tells us that he may be going to set up his tents at Armageddon because he's going to destroy everyone who stands against him. But Zechariah tells us in verse 2, God says, I will gather all the nations together. Whatever reason the Antichrist has, in back of that reason, God is doing his own thing. And about the time they all gather against Jerusalem and they're making war, not so much against Jerusalem, but they're going to just annihilate each other. John said, I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and makes war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one but he himself knows. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood. That's the blood of his enemies, by the way. That's not the blood he shed on the cross. That's the blood of the kings who would defy him. And his name is the Word of God. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Out of his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has this name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Lord over empires, Lord over events, Lord over evil. And then I saw the beast, meaning the Antichrist, the kings of the earth that had gathered to make war against the beast and all of their armies that have gathered at Armageddon. They look up, they see the Lamb coming back to rule the world, and they unite with each other to make war against the Lamb. But the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who performed the miraculous signs on his behalf, and with these signs deluded many, and the two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur. The rest of them were killed with the sword that came out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, which is, by the way, the Word of God. Jesus is the Lord.
Thank you for joining us today for this powerful series from the book of Daniel. Living in the Light is a weekly study in God's Word with teacher and author Ann Graham Lotz. Learn to listen to His voice, then start making the choice to keep on going and believing and trusting who God is. Go to anngrahamlotz.org. Take advantage of the many helpful free resources to get you started. Join us again for Living in the Light.